Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning, and we apologize for being late, but we were at the not the signing of the Declaration of Independence, but at the display of one of the few original copies of the Declaration now in existence and visiting Madison, and we hope that you all will get an opportunity to see it on the first floor, Rotunda East Wing. So, with our apologies, it doesn't happen every day, so thank you for bearing with us. First, I would like to welcome to this session the Badger High School from Lake Geneva. Would those students please stand? Welcome to the Capitol today and to our hearing. Please be seated. We also have Green Bay, and is it Preble or Preble? Students.
Preble.
Are they here? They should stand. And welcome to you all to this session of our court. You may be seated. The students are with us with a Court with Class program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. Students are invited to attend a session of the court. They're given materials about the case we're about to hear, and they may have done some extra work in class about this case. And this is a national award-winning program, and we're delighted to have you with us. Well, we've met you, and now I'd like to introduce the court to you. And starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Now, Justice Sykes will meet with the students and other students who will join us at 11 o'clock at the argument at that time. And she will discuss with the students the procedures of this court. Anyone who would like to attend is cordially invited. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I've been stalling, speaking slowly, waiting for Justice Babbage to come, who left his robe in the car. So they've gone down to the car to find the robe, and as soon as they locate the car and the robe and he gets it on, he will be here. And when he comes, don't tell him I told you or why he's late. And then seated next to the empty chair is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right is Justice David Prosser. So I will now call our first case, 01-0272CR, State versus Hunt. Christopher Wren, Assistant Attorney General, will argue on behalf of the state. And then we will have Rex Andereg arguing on behalf of Mr. Hunt, and then Mr. Wren gets 5 minutes in rebuttal. Welcome to the robed Justice Babbage.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the petitioner state of Wisconsin in this case. In its petition and in its brief, the state presented this court with three questions. First question was whether the other acts test of State versus Sullivan requires an appellate court to reverse a judgment of conviction when the circuit court admits evidence after hearing and agreeing with a Sullivan analysis from one party, but does not, according to the appellate court, adequately state its Sullivan analysis. And two, the record itself supports the circuit court's exercise of discretion. Second question was whether Sullivan requires reversal of a judgment of conviction when the circuit court, in referring to the Sullivan test, specifically finds certain proffered other acts evidence admissible for various reasons. In this case, there were five permissible reasons that the court identified, but erroneously describes the evidence to the lawyers, but not to the jury, as admissible for a sixth improper purpose. And the final question was whether, assuming the circuit court did erroneously admit the other acts evidence, Does a Sullivan violation require reversal of all counts in a judgment of conviction, including those in which the record would have shown that the other act's evidence did not play any role at all? In answering these questions, I'm hoping that the Court will deal with basically five things. One is, at the broadest level, is to reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate these convictions. The second one is to clarify the Court's procedure, the explanation of the Court's procedure, for the appellate review of allegedly erroneous exercises of discretion. The Court actually has two different ways of approaching this, which are not necessarily inconsistent, but can create confusion and potentially lead to an inappropriate or an improper standard of review. The third issue would be who bears the burden on the 90403 inquiry of whether evidence, the probativeness, the prejudice of evidence substantially exceeds its probative value. Does the opponent bear the burden or does the proponent bear the burden? This Court has two cases that are, in fact, in conflict on that question. Fourth, the State would like the Court to reaffirm or at least to make more prominent its observation in footnote 12 of State versus Harvey that the harmless error test is harmless error analysis is something that a court does regardless of whether the parties themselves raise it, that it is a mandatory obligation, much like we regard the independent review doctrine as a mandatory obligation. And the fifth issue is one that will probably, I suspect, will come up, I don't know, because of the recurring nature of the kind of issues that are in this case, and that is, how are there any mechanisms for dealing with the failure of a circuit court to either give reasons or to give adequate reasons for its discretionary decisions? On the first matter involving clarifying the procedure for reviewing allegedly erroneous exercises of discretion, the Court has actually two different tracks on which this proceeds. In Sullivan, Alstein, and McCleary, this Court has said specifically that when a court fails to give reasons for its exercise of discretion, the Court has committed an erroneous exercise of discretion. And that results in what I see as this circularity problem, because the basis for further inquiry is actually the conclusion that the Court should be trying to reach. We start out by saying no reasons equals an erroneous exercise of discretion. At that point, you begin to conduct an independent review, that the erroneous exercise of discretion requires an independent review, and the purpose of the independent review is to decide whether there's been an erroneous exercise of discretion, which is already the point that's been made at the top of this, the top of this chain. That comes specifically out of Sullivan, Alstein, and McCleary.
Counsel, is the purpose of the review to determine whether or not there's been an erroneous exercise of discretion as you advance, or is the purpose of the review, as you set forth on page 15 of your brief, that when a circuit court fails to set forth the reasons, a circuit court's failure to delineate the factors that influenced its decision constitutes erroneous exercise of discretion? You say in your brief, citing Sullivan, when a circuit court fails to do that, appellate courts independently review to determine whether it provides a basis for circuit court exercise of discretion. I see in your brief articulating that the court does independent appellate review not to discern whether or not there's erroneous exercise of discretion, but whether or not the record would support the exercise of discretion.
Well, that whole page, in effect, is a quotation from this Court's decision in Sullivan, which is the way this Court has laid it out. The way I see the Court actually doing it, despite the language that says the lack of a reasons equals an erroneous exercise of discretion, the Court seems to be doing a review to determine whether an erroneous exercise of discretion has actually occurred. And this is where the confusion, I think, comes in from the Court having said at the top that it's the erroneous exercise of discretion, that the Court has erroneously exercised its discretion when it does not give reasons. Maybe I can contrast that by referring the Court to Martindale versus Ripp, where the Court does not
Just say that again. I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry.
What case are you
referring
to?
Martindale versus Ripp, decided a couple of years ago, in which this Court stated it this way. If the circuit court fails to provide reasoning for its evidentiary decision, this court independently reviews the record to determine whether the circuit court properly exercised its discretion. So basically, in Martindale versus Rip, this court has not started out by saying the lack of reasons equals an erroneous exercise.
Well, let's get down to the fifth point then,
okay.
The mechanism for failure. The general rule, which is not limited to other acts evidence, is that when a circuit court fails to reason at all,
right.
It has not exercised its discretion. And a failure to exercise discretion is, as we've used it, an erroneous exercise of discretion. Then you have two lines of cases in this area, but in any number of areas in where there's discretion. And then the two lines of cases are, one, this court was going to review the record to see whether we can uphold the bottom line of the trial court. Another line of cases say we're not going to review it and that we're just going to send it back and let them do it over again. Those are really the two lines of cases I find.
Okay.
What do you find?
Well, I think the court has done that, has sends it back, and it says to go back and do it over again, primarily
right.
in sentencing cases.
That's right, and that's an exercise of discretion.
That's correct. But the sentencing aspect of a case is something that's discrete from doing a whole trial over again. And I think it's in the cases where the issue is whether to do a whole trial over again that the court has been much more reluctant to send it back to be redone.
It may be more reluctant, but that's the issue facing the court. You do
right.
it yourself on the record,
right.
or you send it back.
Yeah, and I think in cases where you deal with the questions of the exercise of discretion in admitting evidence during a trial, that the court has taken the view more frequently than not, and I'm not I can't say that I can really think of many cases, any cases actually, where the court has actually said, we are not even going to look at the record, it just goes back.
Okay.
And
so
part of the, and that, excuse me.
In essence, that's what you want. You want this court to look at the record and see whether or not it can substantiate and support the ultimate decision of the trial court to go ahead in this trial.
Yes, that's the ultimate, that's the
okay.
bottom line.
And how then are we going to, what mechanism are we going to use for the failure of the circuit court to give reasons? We thought Sullivan set it out, and that if the court followed Sullivan, we'd figure it all out then. And you'd get reasoning by both trial counsel for the state, counsel for the defendant. Then the trial court would make this decision, and man, we'd be home free.
Yes. I agree that that's what you want, what Sullivan says you want the courts to do.
Right.
And Sullivan also, as I understand it, says that if the court doesn't do that, you still do the independent review.
And that's what you are. So how, with the mechanism, let's get to five quickly, and then we can do two, three, four.
When a court doesn't give reasons, and it's not so much when I was talking about number five, the mechanisms. What I was trying to think about, how do we encourage courts to do that? And unfortunately, I don't know that there's short of castigating, short of reversal, which punishes the circuit court, but also punishes the litigants. And may force a retrial of a case that would have the exact same evidence come in under if the court gave proper reasons or at least gave some reasons that it hadn't given before. What we're doing is wasting those resources. And that as I understand it, and my view on this is that the independent review doctrine, the harmless error doctrine, are all kind of tied into the notion that we don't want to redo trials that were in fact done appropriately the first time around.
It's not that they were done appropriately; it's that it was harmless error.
Well, in effect, and that's part of my point about the notion that there's two tracks on the Sullivan-Alstein versus the Martindale-Rip tracks. If you start out by saying that no reasons equals an erroneous exercise of discretion, the next step in the analysis ought to be harmless error analysis, which is a beyond a reasonable doubt standard for reviewing a discretionary decision. Martindale versus Rip, which does not make that judgment at the top about whether discretion had been erroneously exercised, puts it into the track where you're reviewing to determine whether discretion was erroneously exercised, where you apply a reasonableness standard. So part of the problem that I have with the idea that no reasons equals equals an erroneous exercise of discretion is that it's confusing in terms of how it relates to harmless error analysis.
Okay. Let's just ask you, is there error here?
Pardon?
Was there error here?
I don't believe so.
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
What evidence was let in that's being objected to?
Well, there was an array of evidence. The defendant objected to, in a sense, all the evidence that the prosecutor wanted to offer. The prosecutor and it's I put the it's in the appendix to the brief, the motion in limine, where the prosecutor wanted to offer some evidence about sexual abuse of two of the other children in this household.
Okay.
Some testimony about drug use and testimony about some physical abuse and sexual abuse of the two wives.
What was the purpose of that? Let's just go through Sullivan.
Okay. The purpose, there were a number of purposes that were offered by the prosecutor. Prosecutor offered it for purpose of intent, for motive, for absence of mistake or accident, to show the context of the charged crimes and the relationship of the defendant and the victim, and primarily because of the recantations that the prosecutor was facing, to show the context, to show why these witnesses were recanting wholesale at trial. Much of the other acts evidence related to the environment in this household, and if the court's familiar with the record, I use the word household kind of advisedly.
Doesn't that come under the rubric of motive?
I think that's correct. I think it comes up, well, not motive
the
so much.
Motive
but,
goes
but,
to the defendant's motive, not the witness's.
Well,
motive.
It goes
not necessarily.
Well, it goes to the motive in certainly in count one, the sexual contact, where the definition of sexual contact involves intentional touching for a specific purpose. What the prosecutor was trying to do with this evidence was to show the context that would result why the witnesses in this horrendous environment they were in would not have gotten up on the stand and reaffirmed what they had told the police officers about a year earlier.
So you are talking about motive of the witnesses.
Well, motive of the witnesses, yes. And I don't know that there's a I didn't come across any cases anyway that talk about motive in terms of the witnesses. But I think that's an appropriate use within the meaning of 90404.
Is that a collateral issue?
I don't think so, because what we're talking about is the credibility of the witnesses, and credibility of witnesses is never a collateral issue.
Okay.
And if you go through the transcript, what you see is routinely the question being asked: do you remember telling the because the witnesses were denying that they had said things or that things had actually happened, in contrast to what they had told police officers and that the officers were going to testify about at the trial, what they had told the officers about the environment in which they lived. What the prosecutor was trying to do was to show that the witnesses in their recantations at trial were lying, and what they had told the officers early on, which were the basis for the charges brought against Mr. Hunt, was in fact the truth.
Now, having led you down that path, let me see if we can pursue it a little bit further. Doesn't it strike you that basically unfair or whatever, that you could use acts of a defendant that clearly are, you know, highly prejudicial, whether or not they come in or not is another question, but they're certainly prejudicial, to reflect not upon the defendant's behavior, but upon a witness's behavior?
No, I don't think that's unfair at all. The witnesses, had they gotten up on the stand and the officers got up on the stand, and none of this other acts evidence had come in for the purpose of assessing the credibility, could have presented that evidence simply to show how the case came to the attention of the officers, what the officers saw as they entered this house, and why that led them to make the decisions about seizing evidence or making arrests, why the charges were then referred over to the DA's office, basically on the issue of completeness in this whole thing.
On basis of what?
Completeness.
Could you pull your microphone?
I'm sorry. Okay. Is that better? Okay. To provide the jury with a complete story about how this came to pass, about how why the officers arrived there. I mean,
what exception is that?
Well, it's the in a sense the completeness exception.
Where do you get the completeness exception? Are you talking about context? Is that
what you're talking about? I think it goes by different names. Context, completeness. I mean, when the officer gets up on the stand and says,
"Write me a case for," I mean, there may be some. I'm familiar with the cases that indicate context, but I'm not familiar with the cases that indicate that completeness is a subject of 90404 sub 2.
Well, the what we've got what I found. In order to provide the jury with a complete understanding of the circumstances of the case, provide the background or context of the case, or when necessary for a full presentation of the case, State versus Bettinger, State versus Hereford, State versus Clemens, State versus Shilcutt.
Okay, I'm chastised.
I mean, you can look them up and decide whether I've given you a fair representation of it, but those were the cases that I came across and I was trying to...
The witness context or defendant context?
Both, from what I can tell.
Is it your position, counsel, looking at 904, because this is novel to me, but apparently a lot of things are novel to me, your position 90404 sub 2, that when we look at what's set out there, that it is for purposes such as proof of motive, mm-hmm. and that can be either defendant or witness. Is that your position here today?
It doesn't restrict it to just the defendant.
And that when we're talking about opportunity, that can be for the defendant or for a witness, as well as intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident. Is that your position?
Some of them will be more appropriate to the defendant than perhaps to witnesses, but I don't think the rule restricts it simply to the defendant. For instance, the absence of mistake or accident, which is one of the reasons that the prosecutor offered in this case. Her reference to mistake or accident, absence of mistake or accident, was referring to the absence of mistake or accident on the part of the witnesses, that they were not misinterpreting what was going on, that they were not accidentally or mistakenly reporting these things to the police.
That's not how the jury was instructed.
I realize that's not how the jury was instructed. That was the reason she gave, and that raises the question of where the discretion has been exercised. The discretion gets exercised, in a sense, at the point where the motion in limine came up. Those were the reasons she offered. And those, I think, are appropriate reasons for allowing it in. The question of whether the court properly instructed the jury on that, I think, is a different question from what comes in under whether you admit the evidence through a Sullivan analysis.
You got the ordinary instruction.
Pardon?
Jury got the pattern instruction.
The jury got essentially the pattern instruction, yes.
Which relates to the defendant.
In that respect, yes. Yes.
Well, you're here on a different ground than the trial judge ruled.
I'm here on the same judge. The trial judge ruled at the beginning. I'm not sure that that's what the jury, when it came to instructing the jury, that the judge used that same rationale. This is one of the issues that kind of comes up in this, in terms of the exercise of discretion when you get a motion in limine, which is really, in a sense, a preliminary determination of the basis for which the evidence can come in. And in this case,
the trial judge said he's letting it in to show propensity to do these acts.
He was letting it in for several reasons. And that was one of the problems I have with the Court of Appeals decision, is they did not address the other reasons. The judge was wrong when he said that it was admissible for propensity reasons. He was right when he said it was admissible for the other five reasons that were offered, for four reasons that the prosecutor offered, and for a fifth reason that the judge himself identified, which was the opportunity reason. The prosecutor never offered opportunity as a reason. The judge, after hearing the offer of proof, the judge himself came up with the opportunity. That, to me, in a sense, without getting into the question of whether there's been a full-blown discussion of the reasons the way Sullivan hopes the court will do it, the fact that the judge came up independently with a reason the prosecutor did not offer indicates to me that he was, in fact, exercising discretion, even if he wasn't articulating it very well.
Counsel,
yes?
I want to pursue this witness-defendant
yes.
split in 904 a little bit more. Let's assume that there has been an offer of proof with respect to the defendant as to other acts, and the court finds, let's say appropriately, that the other acts are not admissible for whatever reason. Let's say the prejudice outweighs the probative value
right.
on any of the intent, motive, et cetera.
Right.
So the district attorney can't get him in on that. Then comes a witness to the stand who's not the defendant, but who is so intertwined in such a way that many of these acts can do, you could ask these questions, the same evidence would show why this witness is lying or why this witness is recanting or whatever. Are you saying that even though the evidence is inadmissible against the defendant, it may still go in and be heard by the jury as to a witness?
What I'm saying, partly yes, partly also what I'm saying is that the ruling on a motion in limine, particularly on the admission of evidence, is in effect a preliminary ruling based on what is known at that time. There's nothing there's nothing that prohibits the developments at trial from leading a judge or an attorney to ask a judge to change the ruling on whether that evidence is admissible. And if the evidence was inadmissible against the defendant, and no discussion was offered at the beginning about whether it would be admissible vis-a-vis the witness's testimony, when the witness gets up on the stand and this starts to come out, I think it's perfectly appropriate for the attorney to ask for a new ruling in light of the development of trial. And I don't think there's anything that prohibits trial judges or attorneys from doing that. We see these motions in limine, the rulings on those, in a sense, relitigated in trials as they develop. We see these, when you read the transcripts, you see, even though it's been the subject of a pretrial ruling, the context of the trial itself, as developments occur, lead the attorneys to try to get those rulings redone. And I don't think there's anything inappropriate in that.
Mr. Rand, how do you see the greater latitude rule entering into this particular case?
Well, in this case, I'd note that the judge himself invoked that, not the prosecutor. My own view is that he really didn't need the greater latitude rule to let it in. It's appropriate to use it in a case like this. There was a minor. This court has said that the greater latitude rule applies in all sexual assault or sexual misconduct cases of this sort, but especially when there's a child involved. Here we had five of the six counts related to a minor, including one in which the minor was impregnated. The sixth was an adult. Even if it had been only an adult, the greater latitude rule would have applied. But in this case, we have five out of six counts involving a minor. I think it could have been
what?
We had five out of the six counts in this case involving a minor, which is where the court says the greater latitude rule is most applicable. So I don't have any problem with it being used. I just don't think, as a practical matter, it really had to be invoked. And I think that's one of the reasons the prosecutor herself did not invoke it.
You take issue with your opposing counsel, who seems to want to restrict the greater latitude rule to situations where the other acts evidence involves only sexual acts against children?
I would not want to restrict it that way. I don't know that in the context of a trial you can actually predict exactly what it's going to be. The similarity of the act certainly goes to issue the I think it's the step two analysis in Sullivan, relevance issues as to probativeness and so on. But certainly the lack of the greater the distance in similarity, it might lead you to say it's not as probative, but I don't think that the difference itself is a sufficient reason to say that the greater latitude rule does not apply.
If your thesis is correct, this is really going to the witness, not the defendant, in terms of context. That seems to be your strongest point. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I hear from you.
In fact, when I talked to the prosecutor herself and we discussed this, that's exactly what she said. She said her concern was making the jury understand why they would recant things like this.
And they don't have to be similar.
I think
just
that's right.
Threats would be enough here, because what you're doing is recantation. You're not trying to prove sexual abuse. So what you have to do is get a context in the house where these people, where the victims are afraid of the defendant.
That's correct.
Therefore, or have some loyalty of one sort or other. So it doesn't have to be the same at all. It could be robbery.
It
didn't have to be sex.
Right. It didn't have to be sex. It didn't have to be anything in particular. It had to be something that from which...
frighten them.
Right, exactly. The phone calls afterwards when he was in jail, that kind of thing.
Anything like that would have done. So the similarity is out in that context.
I think that's correct. I mean, he was not charged with assaulting anybody with a baseball bat, even though that was part of the testimony that had led them to...
And even the timing is not really significant. I mean, it could be after the offense of threats.
I think that's correct.
Because we're dealing with recantation, and that's why this is a very different case than most of the cases that come in under 904.
I think that's correct, because you see cases where you might have one witness testify. Here you've got literally wholesale recantations.
And the trial court here is shifting from one to the other, and most of the time is talking about the defendant, because that's what he's accustomed to talking about.
I think that he was focusing on the defendant quite a bit, and particularly in the jury instruction.
But Ms. Falk focused on both.
She was focusing on both, and particularly in the contact situation on the witnesses.
Right. Now, you have 5 more minutes, but I want you to, if you would, quickly answer, who is the burden where the probative outweighs prejudicial?
This Court has said it two different ways. In State versus Spear, it says that the opponent has the burden.
Ooh.
And the opponent of the evidence has the burden.
Here, that would be the defendant.
Yes. In State versus Sullivan, and in State versus Spear, this Court cited 90403 for that proposition. In State versus Sullivan, without citing anything, the Court put it on the proponent as part of the three-step Sullivan analysis.
Who's the offer of the
The offeror, yes.
State.
The proponent. Mm-hmm. In this case,
here.
The State. The Court did not say in Sullivan that it was overruling Spear. Didn't even cite Spear for that proposition. So I think what we've got is this conflict here that needs to be resolved. I didn't find any cases that, other than those two in Wisconsin, under Federal Rule 403, which is identical to our 90403, the cases uniformly say that it belongs on the opponent.
Opponent.
Opponent, yes. There's one case, if you look at the U.S. Code annotated under the burden issue, you find a citation to a single case. That case was decided by the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit has since, and it holds that the proponent bears the burden under 904, Rule 403. But the Ninth Circuit subsequently, about 9 years later, just last year, in fact, ruled to the contrary, held that the burden lies with the opponent of the evidence. Other cases out of the Sixth Circuit, out of the Seventh Circuit, a district court in the Tenth Circuit have all held that the opponent bears the burden under Rule 403.
Assume at trial it's the proponent who has the burden.
Excuse me?
At trial, it's the proponent of the evidence who has the burden.
Well, the proponent has the burden under 90402 to show relevance. The question is who under 90403, once relevance has been shown, bears the burden of keeping it out. I see that my time is up. Unless there are other questions, I appreciate your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Mr. Enderegg?
Good morning, Justices, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Rex Andreg, and I represent John Hunt, the respondent in this matter. This case was a prosecution for sexual assault. Actually, there were 5 counts, and there was a 6th count, which was exposing a child to harmful materials. It was not a prosecution for an aggravated battery, or drug possession, theft. And it's easy to lose sight of that fact in a case where I think considerably more time was spent establishing the prior bad acts of Mr. Hunt than were actually spent on the actual allegations that were charged. You really have to read this transcript to get an idea of how pervasive and overwhelming this evidence was. And the State, in its reply brief, even acknowledges that it, quote, pervaded every aspect of the trial, close quote. The State argued that it needed this other act's evidence to show how controlling Mr. Hunt was. They said they needed it to show context, credibility, completeness, full presentation of the facts. But when it all comes down to it, it was to show that Mr. Hunt was a controlling individual. And from there it would flow that these witnesses recanted at trial because they were afraid of Mr. Hunt, they were afraid of what he could do to them because of the control that he exercised over them. There's three fundamental problems, I think, with this approach. And the first is that what the State is calling context is really Mr. Hunt's character. There's really no way you can separate the two. This Court has had cases before where there's been multiple prior acts, and it's had cases where there's been an uneasy feeling that perhaps multiple prior acts start to suggest an individual's character, but there were some redeeming value in doing that, some permissible purpose. This Court has never seen a case where the prior acts and the character of the defendant merge so completely and they're so intertwined as they are in this case that it's impossible really to extract any useful value.
Well, Mr. Anderegg, how can the State show the reason for a witness recanting? I mean, it attacks the credibility of the witness. Do you think that's a collateral issue that can't be brought up, or you think the State has a right to explain recantation? And if so, how do you do it?
Well, I think the State has a right to explain recantation, and I think it could have done that in this case without going into all of the prior acts. There were certainly plenty of facts that were contemporaneous and that were reported on the night that the whole episode began that would have gone a long way to establishing the type of context and environment that the State wanted to establish. There were facts that the individuals in the household were made to stay upstairs. There were facts that they were afraid of Mr. Hunt. There were allegations that he went everywhere with them, that he considered himself a minister and that he preached at scriptures at them. There were all sorts of facts that were sort of part of the whole story that they could have used to establish the credibility of the witnesses without going to acts that happened up to 30 years ago that really had nothing to do with the particular incident.
Can you give me a list of some of those? Which ones did you find most egregious?
Well, the most egregious one was one that actually had occurred about 30 years ago where Mr. Hunt was alleged to have, punched his wife in the face or in the mouth so hard that it required her to get 22 stitches. Then there were other acts that were of similar nature, that he was hitting her with a knife, put a knife to her throat, and there were allegations of abuse that were probably about, I think, 5 or 6 years before the actual crimes charged. And then there were a host of other allegations that were very abusive in nature, for which you're really not sure on the record what the time frame was, because they were just sort of thrown out there as prior acts that had occurred, and we don't really know when. I think the most egregious one, though, probably the prototypical one, is the one from 30 years ago.
Well, what relationship does the fact that the defendant sexually molested other young women of 15 have to do with a recantation?
Well, I don't think that has anything to do with the recantation. I believe that evidence was offered on the question of intent or motive, which was an element of one of the charges that were pending before the court. And that, other than the argument which was made to the Court of Appeals regarding a Wallerman stipulation, which may be become somewhat moot at this point, but other than that particular argument, those prior acts, the ones that were sexual in nature, the ones for which the greater latitude rule would apply, were not, had not been challenged or were not challenged.
You're not challenging those.
Not challenging those.
You're challenging the physical violence ones that are not sexual and the ones that are too old.
That's correct.
And of this, how many are we talking about?
How many different acts?
Yeah.
I haven't actually counted them. I have 15 of them that are listed in my brief. I think there were 25, 30 different allegations against Mr. Hunt.
Other than the sexual acts?
Other than the sexual acts.
Sexual acts you'd let in on similar offenses to show intent and motive?
Yes.
That's not what you complain about.
That's not what I'm complaining about. However, getting to the issue of the jury instruction, it might be a good juncture to make an interesting point, and that is these acts, ones that were sexual in nature, and then the ones that were physical abuse and drug use and thefts and that kind of thing, they were let in, or should have been let in, for very different reasons. And yet no effort was made to explain to the jury that these acts were let in for different reasons. There was just one instruction that gave the permissible purposes without any attempt to differentiate what they were for.
Did you object to the jury instruction?
Well, Mr. Hunt did object to the jury instruction to a certain extent. To an other certain extent, he assented to the jury instruction, and I wished he hadn't done that. However, he did object to the use of accident, absence of mistake or accident being as part of the jury instruction, as well as opportunity. And he certainly objected to letting this evidence in the first place.
So let me just understand. I want to just talk about the sexual assault involving Tiffany. So are you arguing that that could not stand by itself, that particular charge, if we were to send this back or do something with it, can we separate that one out?
That the particular sexual assault resulting in pregnancy
That's
to
correct.
Tiffany. I don't think that you can separate that matter out, and I think that's what essentially because of the evidence was so strong. Is that the
question? Yeah. Well, why couldn't we separate it? That's what I would.
Well, first of all,
why shouldn't we?
First of all, I think the question of harmless error was not one that had been raised by the state, and so I would preface my remarks by saying I think that they've waived a harmless error argument in that regard. But I'm not sure how the state or any court could say that the other acts.
We can't find, you're saying because they haven't raised it, we can't use harmless error.
Well, that's, I would encourage the court to conclude that they have waived that harmless error argument but not raising
it. Now, you know, the court isn't bound by a waiver.
I understand.
That's why I'm dealing with your jury instruction. You waived it. Your client waived by not objecting fully to that jury instruction, objected on grounds that now are really irrelevant, but didn't object on the sound ground. So why haven't you waived it?
Well, I would argue that, number one, Mr. Hunt did object to the use of the other acts evidence, a general objection, and that he did argue that the prejudicial effect outweighed the probative value. And, I think in one sense he probably shouldn't have been in that situation in the first place since he had fought vigorously to keep that out. And so I would argue that it may not be appropriate to apply a waiver rule under these circumstances where he did sort of lodge an overall objection. I would also ask the court to consider the fact that the district attorney who sought admission of this evidence and the court which ruled that it was admissible, I think also had some responsibility to craft an instruction which accurately reflected the basis for its admission. The district attorney has never promoted opportunity, plan or preparation, absence of motive or absence of mistake or accident as permissible purposes, and that's the instruction that the jury was given. And in fact, the state has not really even pursued those particular purposes in their briefs to the Court of Appeals or even in its initial brief to this court. So all along, the argument from the state has been that it's context that was the reason this stuff is coming in. And I think there's some obligation on their part to see that that's what the instruction stated. By the time Mr. Hunt was asked his opinion, it had already been established that it was coming in for these other purposes, which, and in essence, he was facing sort of an impossible situation at that point because these other purposes, I don't think, really made much sense. And the court had already indicated that it was inclined not to give the instruction on context and stated something very curious when doing that. The court's reasoning was rather remarkable. It said it didn't want to include context as part of the instruction because it was concerned that it might limit the jury and how they would use this evidence.
Where did they say that at the original motion in limine?
That was at the jury instruction conference. Mm-hmm. That was when that remark was made by the court.
Well, who raised context?
At the jury instruction?
Yes.
Well, the court, I think the court brought it up, and the district attorney certainly brought it up because that was her basis for it wanting the evidence in, and then there was some discussion, and the court started to say, well, I'm not really inclined to instruct on context because it might limit the jury too much in how they might use that evidence, and it would be difficult to describe exactly what we mean by context. And
what's your position, that the judge had already made a ruling and objection was no longer necessary?
Essentially, yes, and that they did ask Mr. Ziemer, defense counsel, his opinion, what do you think? And he said he didn't want it.
Well, on your issue of that, you don't want to be held to harmless error, but you want to hold the state to harmless error. And Mr. Wren cited footnote 12 in State v. Harvey, in which the court said this harmless error is an issue for the court, and it's an obligation of the court to raise it, regardless of whether either party raised it.
So,
what's your response to that?
Well, my response is that the court certainly can undertake a harmless error analysis and may be required to. Yet, getting back to that issue, I don't believe that that this was harmless error. When you have the depth and the number of prior acts that were admitted in this case, I don't know how you can argue harmless error, even with regard to the particular count resulting in pregnancy that was mentioned by Justice Wilcox. Certainly, it's interesting to note that the state, in seeking to admit this evidence, never attempted to distinguish between the pregnancy charge and all of the other charges. And in fact, they sought admission of these acts for very broad purposes to show the context and the credibility of the witnesses. And that certainly is the type of purpose that's going to encompass all of the charges. I mean, it's not something that's just going to touch on five of the six charges. And finally, I guess I would argue that all defendants, even the ones that are most guilty, are entitled to have their guilt or their innocence determined by a jury and not by an appellate court. And essentially, the harmless error question in this scenario is asking this court to hypothesize a jury verdict that was never rendered.
Well, we had DNA evidence that showed over 99% chance that he was the father, right?
Yes.
What do you think the chances are that the jury is going to say that he has not sexually assaulted this minor? You don't have to show consent, do you?
No.
All you have to do is show an act, right?
That's correct.
And so that act is shown by a pregnancy with a 99.9% right?
Correct.
So if you apply a test that would the jury have found this person guilty? Doesn't the answer have to be yes?
It does. I mean, I can't deny that with that type of evidence that the likelihood is that on that particular account, a jury would convict Mr. Hunt again. Nevertheless, I maintain that that's what a jury should do. And we should give the jury the opportunity to do that and not do that for the jury. And an opportunity to do that in a trial, which is devoid of all of this other baggage that was dragged in from over 30 years into this particular trial.
So you're saying this is a perfect trial. That's why I asked the question on separating that particular, as the Chief Justice was exploring that issue, out from all of these other issues. And you're saying because it was so intertwined, bound up with, it was impossible for that jury, and yet when you have, you have the pregnancy, you have the 99 point something, you're saying that another jury should be given the opportunity to hear that.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that Mr. Hunt, whether he's the most guilty person or not, is entitled to have a trial where that evidence is certainly was admissible, the DNA evidence.
But how was that affected by the, that's what I want to, what was the effect?
Well, I think the effect is that you've got somebody that's been portrayed as really a bad individual, a bad character. And certainly, DNA tests are not infallible, and certainly 99% is not 100%. And Mr. Hunt also wished to present some other evidence, which wasn't allowed, which is another issue that was raised in the Court of Appeals. But there's always the possibility, too, that, on another trial, that issue would have to be decided again. But there was evidence that there were some relatives of Mr. Hunt that may have had an opportunity to have impregnated this woman, and that I think the DNA expert would have acknowledged that that sort of creates a larger pool of potential fathers. But in any event, my argument is that the trial should not have been based, or should, the other act's evidence really sort of overtook the actual trial of the issues. And I think from a factual perspective, that makes this case very unique, aside from the other issues, including the independent review doctrine. From a factual perspective, this court, I don't think, is going to see many cases, at least I hope they don't see as many cases from the defense perspective, that has this depth and a number of other prior acts that were involved. I also, to echo a point that was raised by counsel here, would agree that I think there's some definite tension here between this court's decision in Sullivan and the independent review doctrine. I read Sullivan as asking courts and councils across the state to carefully delineate the permissible purpose that the evidence is being introduced for, and to identify what it's to be used for, and don't just throw in a whole laundry list of things. And I also read Sullivan as talking about the importance of instructing the jury with precision as to what the evidence is coming in for. However, with the independent review doctrine, if upper court or appellate court can sort of validate what happened, the introduction of prior acts evidence on a different basis and even for a different purpose, you better be sure that you've instructed the jury as to that particular purpose if you're going to use a different one in the appellate court level. There's an incentive, I think, for the courts at the lower level to let it in for as many different purposes as possible, which is, I think, contrary to what this court wanted in Sullivan. In other words, you might as well rule it admissible for a whole bunch of reasons and instruct the jury on a whole bunch of reasons, because if it turns out that the appellate court above is going to validate it on a perhaps a different reason, you want to have as many in the instruction as possible. And there's this tension there. And I think that the only way, I think in Sullivan, this court frowned upon admitting evidence for a reason that you haven't told the jury, haven't instructed the jury on. And I think the one way to resolve this is for this court to take a narrow view of also instructing the jury on other permissible purposes that aren't really the purpose that you've let it in for, even if you do instruct them on the reason that you let them in for. If you give them a bunch of other ones, that creates a lot of confusion, I think, in terms of how they're going to use that evidence. And so I would encourage the court to look at it from that perspective as well.
Counsel, one of the things that struck me is when your opposing counsel advanced the argument of not wanting to punish the circuit court in these cases. And that stuck in my mind because I, in part, interpreted the Court of Appeals decision as a decision of not wanting to punish the Court of Appeals. That is, this record can be viewed as quite problematic. The state coming in and saying we want context and maybe throwing in a couple of other things at the tail end, the judge then saying, oh, how about, you know, opportunity and mistake, and maybe even throws in plan a little later, and without articulating at all what Sullivan had indicated and has set forth in the first several pages of the state's brief, you know, this step-by-step analysis. And I interpreted the Court of Appeals handling this case as they did, with a summary reversal. We don't see too many of these summary reversals on oral argument, as kind of saying, hey, you know, you've got the 25 to 30 other acts in the record. You haven't articulated really why. You've thrown in the kitchen sink, and so we're throwing this back at you. Now, they don't say that. Am I reading too much into the opinion? But that's the way I see it, which follows from your advancing the argument of independent appellate review. I mean, they can throw in the kitchen sink. They cannot do any analysis because no matter how wrong they get it, if the Court of Appeals is required to do independent analysis as part of the methodology, then why bother?
I also viewed the Court of Appeals decision in that fashion, and was taken by the fact that it was a summary disposition, and then note that in or looked up in the Walther's appellate practice book and noted that he stated that summary dispositions are probably most appropriate where, quote, the trial court was so clearly in error and acted so contrary to well-established law in rendering its judgment that this will be readily apparent to the Court of Appeals. I think that's why we had a summary disposition in this case, because, I mean, the error doesn't get any clearer than the statement that the trial court judge is letting the evidence in because it shows the defendant's propensity to act in conformity therewith. You know, you're not going to get an error that's any clearer than that. And I wish the Court of Appeals had maybe been a little bit more long-winded on what they were doing and perhaps explained, kind of like they have done in other cases where they were unhappy with sentencing discretion being exercised by Milwaukee Court Circuit judges. But I mean, that's how I read the decision as well, and that there was just the error was just too much, and it was they didn't follow Sullivan, and it was Court of Appeals' attempt, I think, to say you created a huge mess here, and you're going to have to unravel it. We're not going to.
Counsel, who has the burden whether the probative value outweighs its prejudicial value under 904, Chapter 904? The state says we have two conflicting lines of cases.
I agree with that. I saw that Speer and Sullivan seem to be conflicting in that regard, and my position would be that Sullivan, being the more recent pronouncement, is the one that should be controlling, especially since we're talking about applying it in a test that has come to be known as the Sullivan test, that we ought to look at Sullivan, because Sullivan sort of reconfigured the test, so to speak.
Can you cite me to the page in Sullivan where that is set forth?
I believe it's 674.
Well, no, because it starts at 768.
So.
Mr. Wren will look at that while we're
okay
talking.
It was near the beginning of the opinion. But I do believe that Sullivan is controlling on that issue.
I think it's paragraph 16 or someplace in that area. The proponent of the evidence in this case, the state, bears the burden of persuading the circuit court that the three-step inquiry is satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the paragraph that I was referring to. Another problem, I think, with the state's effort to demonstrate that Mr. Hunt was a controlling individual is that there was virtually no effort to relate most of the acts that occurred to Tiffany, who was the primary victim here. I mean, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that of the five of the six counts that were at issue here, Tiffany was the victim. In the sixth count, it was Angelica Johnson, another woman who lived in the home. Yet most of these prior acts, and especially the most egregious ones, involved Ruth, who was Mr. Hunt's wife, but who was really not a victim in any of the charges. In some of the acts, the one that I had referred to before as being the most egregious one, occurred years before Tiffany was even born. And with regard to the others, there was really no effort to show that Tiffany was aware of them. So in terms, if you want to talk about recantations and the credibility of the witnesses, you can't just start dredging up a lot of acts unless you also demonstrate that the witness is aware of those acts. They don't really have any probative value otherwise. And another point that I tried to make was that I'm not sure how much probative value this whole prior acts evidence had in terms of recantation and credibility to begin with, because it really cuts both ways. If Mr. Hunt is really a terrible individual who's doing all of these abusive and terrible things to these people, the record will reflect that he was in custody during the whole time the trial was pending and was never released. This was a perfect opportunity for these people to come in, and if these things had really happened to them, to get up on the witness stand and nail it to Mr. Hunt and get him out of their lives forever. I understand the state's argument to the contrary, but understanding that this evidence can cut both ways, I think, says a lot about its probative value. So as I was stating, there not being any evidence or any effort to show that Tiffany was aware of a lot of these prior acts, and the fact that the acts themselves are really not similar at all to the charges, what do they really have in common, the prior acts, with the charges? And the answer is control. It's interesting to examine how the other acts' evidence become relevant in this particular case. They become relevant because they demonstrate Mr. Hunt is a very controlling person, and because the crimes that he's charged with are also acts of control, it goes to the idea that he was acting in conformity. And in this respect, the trial court was exactly right when it said that it would show his propensity. Getting back to Justice Bradley's question, as to what the Court of Appeals was actually doing here, I'm of the opinion that the Court of Appeals, did all that it had to do in this case, because there was such overkill and such thorough use of prior bad acts, and it was so cumulative, as the state has acknowledged, it pervaded every aspect of the trial, and that many of them were so temporally disconnected to the relevant facts at trial that there was just no way that any probative value could overcome the prejudicial effect of their admission. And so I think that once the Court of Appeals realized that and got to that point, it decided that there wasn't really any purpose or any need for it to go and independently review the entire record and try to look at the first two prongs of the Sullivan test, because it was clear on its face that the third prong had not been satisfied. And I also believe that the Court of Appeals may have focused almost exclusively, or at least largely, on the question of context, because the state had not argued the other permissible purposes in its brief. And then when it further realized that no jury instruction had been given on the question of context. The court felt that this greatly exacerbated the prejudicial effect. And had the Court of Appeals had the state telling it context, 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 but the record revealed that the jury had never been told to use it in that fashion.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up unless you want to summarize very promptly and quickly.
No, I'm finished, Judge.
Okay, thank you. Wren?
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points. There are a number that he's raised. I'm not sure that I have enough time to address them all. In terms of the question about what the Court of Appeals was actually doing, I think it's important to note that the Court of Appeals never said anything about counsel having failed to do their duty under Sullivan. The focus of the Court of Appeals opinion was entirely on what the trial court did. So I think it's not fair to say that what the court was doing was saying that there'd been sort of a wholesale failure on the Sullivan analysis. I think what the circuit court did in effect, and I gave this example earlier, that it did exercise discretion. It may not have articulated it very well, but one of the examples that I offer for inferring that it exercised discretion was the fact that it chose to select opportunity as one of the appropriate reasons for admitting the evidence, even though the prosecutor never offered it. The court heard the offer of proof, heard the discussion. Both the prosecutor and defense counsel did what this court wanted them to do in Sullivan, which was to articulate the reasons for admitting it, articulate the reasons for excluding it, and then hopefully the judge would make an articulated reason for admitting it. The court here, the circuit court here, I think was attempting to do that. I don't know whether you think it was articulate enough or not. I think I was not real pleased with how well the court articulated it, but I think the court was saying, and it accepted, the reasons that the prosecutor offered and came up with one of its own reasons. Its reference to propensity was clearly out of bounds, but the Court of Appeals, when it was deciding this stuff, mentioned only context as an appropriate reason, despite the fact that it had been offered for other appropriate reasons, and focused exclusively on the propensity as a reason for excluding, which sets up a rule that says if you have good reasons and bad reasons, the bad reasons control the good reasons, which I think is contrary to what this court and the Court of Appeals has routinely said, that when a court gives no reasons or even wrong reasons, if the record supports correct reasons, the court will affirm.
Counsel, I want to know how broad that premise is. Are you advancing when there are no reasons given that this court, or not adequate reasons or not adequate explanation, that this court only in this context should be engaging in independent appellate review and go through the analysis, or is it in a much broader context?
I think it's any time that there's a discretionary decision and the court does not give reasons. And to give an example, in an actual trial where the court gets an objection and the attorney says, object hearsay, the trial judge will say sustained or overruled. No reasons are given, yet it's a discretionary decision that may be reviewed. The appellate courts don't treat that.
You mentioned that previously in terms of, okay, you know, when there's been a full trial.
Right.
But it seems to me, take family law. You know, those are all trials to the court, okay? Maintenance, erroneous exercise of discretion if no reason is given. I mean, if the court said, I'm going to give you $3,000 a year in maintenance or, $500 a month and doesn't give any reason, are we then to search the record? Is it your position that's what we should be doing, searching the record in all areas of law? I just pick family law. Juvenile law issues, not just sentencing, not just full trials. I mean, the premise would, I think, apply that you're advancing in all areas of law. And it seems to me, if I were a trial court judge, I wouldn't care what the record said, because then the Court of Appeals is going to have to take care of it anyway, as long as there's enough evidence in there.
Well, I understand that risk, and I'm very sympathetic to it, because I am arguing for a broad view. And from the point of view of an appellate attorney, that puts me in a bind as well, because if I'm going to argue that the court ought to be engaging in independent review, one of my jobs as an attorney is to help the court. So I'm going to have to do the independent review as well if I want to aid the court in the way that I think I'm supposed to be doing at the appellate level. In the criminal appeals unit, this is a major problem for us, because we know we want the courts to be given good reasons because it simplifies our job.
There's no incentive, though, with your approach to do that.
I understand there's no incentive, and that's one of the problems. I understand that that's a problem. Part of what I hope, and maybe this is a hope triumphing over experience in this instance, what I'm hoping is that we will have judges who take their job seriously, who take this court's admonition seriously. And when they don't, maybe we get decisions. Maybe what we need are more decisions like State versus Hall, where District 1 went out and castigated in public a judge for routinely not doing the job he's supposed to be doing. I don't know that there is a good solution short of wasting a lot of resources when judges don't give the reasons that this court wants them to do. The choice is you reverse the convictions, you reverse the trials, send it back, and maybe have to go through a whole new jury trial again, calling in witnesses, taking up the judge's time, taking up the court's time, taking up witnesses' time. Or you can try to ameliorate that and use other mechanisms other than reversal to get the courts to do what they want to do. I really like getting cases where Judge D'Amato has had a discretionary decision, because I can almost always count on having very nice articulated reasons. It makes it very easy to write a brief. It makes it very easy for the Court of Appeals and this Court to review them.
Wasn't that the whole point of State v. Sullivan, of laying it out so that the burden was on prosecutor, on defense counsel, and on judge?
Right. And I think what happened in this case was the two attorneys did their job. I think the trial judge did his job, although I confess I don't think he did it very well. I think what he was doing, what he ultimately did, was basically adopt without saying so what the prosecutor was asking him to do. Whether that satisfies Sullivan, that's going to be for this court to call. I think it does. I think when a trial court making a discretionary decision in effect makes the ruling in favor of one of the parties, then in effect the court is adopting that party's rationale.
That's a little dangerous, isn't it?
It might be. And maybe the party's rationale is not good, and that becomes a basis for reversal.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Prosser.
I thought I understood you to say that one reason why this should not be remanded is that all the evidence that was introduced the first trial would simply come in again with a better justification. But I take from Mr. Anderegg his impression that the Court of Appeals said that the very volume of this other act's evidence was prejudicial. And I assume he would argue that you can't have all of this evidence come in again.
I don't read the Court of Appeals decision as saying that. I think the Court of Appeals was lamenting the trial what it perceived as the trial judge's failure to adequately explain, and also because it regarded the propensity reason as, in effect, the only reason the judge was letting it in. If we go back to the trial and the witnesses continue to recant, assuming the witnesses can then be found, the problem will reassert itself. We'll be back into the same issue of, can this evidence be introduced to show context, to explain why the witnesses are recanting? If the witnesses don't recant, we have an entirely different situation. A lot of this evidence doesn't have to come in as a way of helping the jury understand and make credibility judgments about the witnesses. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Thank you, Mr. Anderegg, for your arguments in State v. Hunt. This concludes 01-0272-CR, and we again apologize that we were late in beginning today. We'll take just a few moments so that the students who are leaving will leave, and the new group of students may come in. Thank you.
talking.
That's my stomach rumbling.
Thank you for setting a trap for my opponent.
Yeah.
Take care.